contained the day-to-day detritus of a lonely bachelor. Andrea was there with him when he first set foot in Uncle Ted's house. She saw the dishes in the rack by the kitchen sink, the pie-crust table that supported a rotary phone and the King James Bible, the two single beds side by side in the house's only bedroom. On the bedside table was a photograph of Ted and Caleb in front of the barn, holding chickens in their arms like babies. Andrea was there because she decided before the steamship even docked that Jeffrey needed her help. What he was doing, seeing the farm for the first time, taking inventory, and uncovering the life of the man who had left it to him, was not something he should do without a friend. She was right. She helped him find someone to clean out the house. She showed him where the town building was so he could register the deed in his name. She drove him around in her black Jeep with the top down, even though Nantucket in May was cold and windy and rainy. Did anything grow here? Jeffrey had to wonder. Maybe the farm was a joke. She took him for chowder and steamed lobsters and scallops wrapped in bacon. She let him crash on the floor of her room in the rental house that she shared with two other lifeguards. And then, after a full week of this platonic, almost sisterly help, she invited him into her bed and took his virginity. Because, yes, Jeffrey had been a virgin at 22. Owing to his girlfriend Felicity Hammer's love of Jesus and her refusal to make love to him until the day they were married. Andrea was different from Felicity in every way. Andrea was strong and athletic and dark-haired and capable and Italian and Catholic and confident of her many talents and charms. Felicity was blonde and petite and meek and easily frightened. She was shy and God-fearing. She was a small-town Baptist whose father had sent her to community college. She was a baker and a knitter. She wanted 6 children. Felicity had thought that once Jeffrey got settled with the farm, he would send for her and they would get married. But meeting Andrea at the ketchup dispenser changed that. Andrea was a storm, a force of nature. He could not resist her any more than he could stop the rain. They fell in love. In October, they moved into the tiny farmhouse, now clean, cozy, and all fixed up. They made love. They made pasta. They made curtains for the windows. Jeffrey made a plan for the farm. He got rid of all the livestock except for the chickens. Chickens and eggs he could handle. Everything else was too expensive and beyond the perimeters of his expertise. He wanted to grow things. Corn, vegetables, flowers. He had no money. He went to the bank for a loan way beyond what he would be able to pay back in this lifetime, but they gave him the money eagerly, with the land as collateral. Andrea got a job teaching private swim lessons at the community pool. They were happy. They talked about getting married. They talked about kids. They ate a lot of eggs. They had nicknames for each other. He called her Andy. She called him Peach, which had something to do with sex, how he tasted, or the fact that he'd been a virgin until she took a bite out of him. Life was weird, right? It was weird because Jeffrey and Andrea had been happy. They had been a couple on their way to matrimony and wedded bliss until somehow it unraveled. As though a sweater had a snag and he pulled at it, or she did, and one by one the stitches came undone until it was a pile of yarn at their feet. Jeffrey was obsessed with the farm, consumed by it. He could not give Andrea his full attention. He could not give her any attention. She complained. He heard her complaining, but he could do nothing about it. He was single-minded. He always had been. And his mind was on the farm, the fields, the crops, the business of it. At the beginning of their 3rd summer together, Andrea, once again Nantucket's head lifeguard, went to a party for town employees where she met the new police chief. Young guy, she said, single, from Swampscott. And 2 weeks later, she moved out. In all honesty, Jeffrey was too busy to do anything to stop her. By the time he got off his goddamn tractor in the figurative sense, Andrea and the new police chief, Ed Kapanash, were engaged. Life was weird, because instead of Jeffrey's relationship with Andrea ending, it started a new incarnation. At first, Jeffrey was tentatively friends with the newlywed Kapanashes. Then Jeffrey met Delilah, and they became couple friends with Ed and Andrea. Andrea's cousin Tess started dating Greg, and they moved to the island permanently. Then Phoebe and Addison joined the scene, and the eight of them, over time, developed an insanely tight bond. What did Delilah call them? The castaways. And it did, at times, seem like just the eight of them, alone on a deserted island. Life was weird, because although Jeffrey had seen Andrea every week for nearly 20 years, seeing her now sitting in his chair was sort of like seeing her for the first time. On a rolling boat by the ketchup dispenser? You do talk. It was as if he'd looked up, finally, after getting the farm running, profitable and fully staffed, and noticed that she was gone. And he went looking for her. And he found her here, in his chair. Because there was something about her that transported him back. The nickname, Peach. Or the way it was just the two of them here, alone, unlikely to be interrupted. Had that happened even once since they split? Or it was the way she was looking at him. "What are you doing here?" he asked her. She said, "I'm having a hard time." He said, "She worshipped you, Andrea. You were her friend and her sister and her mother wrapped up into one. You did right by her." Her tears were silent. "How can you say that? She's dead." "It was an accident." "Was it? Wasn't it?" Jeffrey said. He shifted on the milk crate. He had a nugget of classified information that no one else knew, that had been lobbed at him like a hand grenade by April Peck. I was with him the night before he died. But what did that mean? Did it mean anything? Was it even true? In his heart, Jeffrey felt it was true. He realized now that Greg had been hiding something. One thing was for sure. Jeffrey was not going to share this radioactive nugget with Andrea. "I don't know," Andrea said. "All I can tell you is that I'm in agony. I am hurting worse than I could ever imagine I could hurt. Like I lost one of the kids. Like a stranger came into my house and held Casey's head under the bathwater until she died. And I wasn't around. I let it happen." "Greg was the stranger?" Jeffrey said. "He was Tess's husband. 12 years they were married. He made her miserable." "Did he?" Jeffrey said. Jeffrey's understanding of Greg and Tess's marriage, before April Peck, was that Tess had loved Greg with the same ardor and enthusiasm that she loved everyone else in her life. "So you wish you'd, what, spoken up at their wedding when the priest offered the chance?" "He hurt her," Andrea said. "Last fall, that whole thing, he cut her heart out, and she was never the same. The week they separated? God, Jeffrey, we talked for hours. She was trying to make sense of it. Do you think he lied to me? Do you think he lied to Flanders? Do you think something happened between him and that girl?" "And the answer is, yes, of course. Something happened. We don't know what. We'll never know exactly what. And there's Greg sending flowers and hounding her cell phone and calling the house begging and pleading." "Yeah," Jeffrey said. "That was a weird week." While Tess was at the Kapanash house with the twins, Greg had taken refuge at Jeffrey and Delilah's. It was, of all awful things, the week of Thanksgiving, the holiest family holiday. But despite that, or maybe because of that, Tess decided to take the kids and leave. She had meant to go to her brother's house in Pembroke to visit her mother at the nursing home in Duxbury, but in the end she had simply sought refuge with Andrea. She slept with Andrea in Andrea's bed, and the kids slept in the guest room. And Greg, although he had his house to himself, slept on Jeffrey and Delilah's leather couch each night. He never stayed over intentionally. Otherwise, he would have used the guest room. He came over for dinner and drinks, and he and Delilah stayed up so late talking, and he was so drunk that he ended up crashing on the couch. And in the morning, he would be awakened by Drew and Barney and SpongeBob SquarePants. He would eat Delilah's delicious breakfasts, talk about going home to grab a shower, but then there would be college football and lunch and Barney begging him to play the guitar, and he just stayed on and on. A few of those nights, Greg and Delilah worked at the Begonia and came home absurdly late, Jeffrey was busy at the farm market. The kitchen had orders for 300 fresh turkeys and 6 times that many side dishes. And if he didn't catch every nuanced detail of what was going on, could anyone blame him? Delilah was the head paramedic of this particular train wreck. She was in charge of tending to Greg. Jeffrey noted Greg's attempts to reach Tess, but she was not taking his calls. He heard about a bouquet of flowers sent and returned to the florist by Tess. Jeffrey wasn't sure how he felt about the whole thing. What he wanted was to stay out of it. This was, no doubt, what the chief was doing, and this was what Addison and Phoebe were doing. The prize fight was between Tess and her trainer, Andrea, and Greg and his trainer, Delilah, in the opposite corner. Jeffrey did not love it that his house had inadvertently become Greg's camp. He felt like he was harboring a fugitive. There had been one night in particular that bothered Jeffrey. It was 4:30 in the morning, and Jeffrey was rising for the day when he noticed that Delilah was not in bed. He tiptoed out to the kitchen for coffee, and he heard Greg's voice. Greg was murmuring to someone. Although Jeffrey was the last person to eavesdrop, he couldn't help it. And God damn it, this was his house. Jeffrey thought, if he is talking to Delilah like that, I am going to throw him out. Because, really, Jeffrey had had enough of the Greg and Delilah confidant thing. Greg was not good for Delilah, or for Jeffrey and Delilah's marriage. But when Jeffrey reached the kitchen, he saw that Greg was on his cell phone. Greg noticed Jeffrey and said quickly, "I'll call you later," and hung up. And then, despite the fact that Greg had seen Jeffrey and Jeffrey had seen Greg, Greg closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep. Delilah, as it turned out, was upstairs sleeping with Barney, who tended to wake up in the middle of the night and want his mother. Jeffrey did not say anything to Greg about the phone call, but he knew it wasn't Tess on the other end. Then there was Thanksgiving itself. Tess had seeded a little ground and allowed Greg to see the kids in the morning. Greg had hoped for a family reconciliation for the holiday, and learning that he was only gaining custody for 4 hours, like the divorced man he was sure to become, depressed him. He had nothing planned. Delilah suggested that he take the kids to breakfast at the Downy Flake or for a walk on the beach, but Greg seemed eager to avoid quality time when the twins might have a chance to ask him questions he was ill-equipped to answer, such as, "Why is Mom so mad at you?" or "Why are we living at Auntie's house?" Instead, Greg took the twins over to the Drake house, and this, in combination with the overheard phone call, led Jeffrey to understand that Greg was lost, hapless, and in possession of the maturity of a 12-year-old boy. Jeffrey, therefore, took over. He rescued the kids from the PlayStation by driving everyone to the farm where they went for a hayride. Jeffrey drove the tractor, and Delilah and Greg sat in the back with the kids. The kids liked the bumps, and Jeffrey obliged them. The day was sunny but cold. Jeffrey took the long way, all the way around the edge of the property. Time and circumstances were suspended. Everyone had fun, and at the end of the ride they drank apple cider and ate moist pumpkin muffins, and then suddenly it was 1 o'clock. Delilah had to get home to check on the turkey, and Greg had to get the kids back to the Capenash house. Normally the 8 of them, plus the 6 kids, had Thanksgiving dinner together, and Delilah and Andrea alternated years hosting. This year it felt like they had all divorced. The chief and Andrea had Tess and the kids. Jeffrey and Delilah had Greg. Phoebe and Addison, not wanting to take sides, went to the Ship's Inn by themselves. It felt awful. Jeffrey, Delilah, Greg, and Drew and Barney held hands around the table and said grace, but when they looked up, they could see how wrong everything was. Jeffrey thought about Ed and Andrea's table, with Eric and Casey and Tess and the twins, and he wondered if things felt wrong there, too. He hoped they did. Jeffrey never found out how or why, but by Sunday night, Greg and Tess were back at home with the kids. 4 weeks later, the 8 of them were on vacation in Stowe, and everything was back to normal. Tess had forgiven Greg, forgotten April Peck, and moved on. Now Andrea was taking the credit for this, or the blame. I convinced Tess to take him back, for the kid's sake. Ed and I both thought that was the best thing.
It was the best thing, Jeffrey said.
How can you say that? Andrea said. She was shaking and crying. Her face was wet with tears. Jeffrey wanted to reach out to her, to hold her. He had lost her so long ago, when he wasn't watching. And although it was his fault completely, it had never seemed fair. Now she was back. She needed something, and he would try like hell to give it to her.
How can you say that when she's dead?
Remember when Tess came to visit us, Jeffrey said, and she borrowed my bike? Andrea wiped at her tears.
And she insisted on riding it barefoot, and she fell and
broke her arm, Jeffrey said.
But we didn't believe her, Andrea said. We didn't believe her when she said how much it hurt. We made her go to the movies.
And we saw The Player.
And it was the best movie of all time.
And we couldn't figure out why Tess was crying at the end.
And it was because of her arm.
We took her to the hospital, Jeffrey said. You stayed by her side while they x-rayed her and set it.
You stayed in the waiting room, Andrea said, and fell asleep across four chairs.
I felt so guilty, Jeffrey said. It was my bike.
I felt so guilty, Andrea said. She told me her arm was broken and I gave her some Advil and told her to toughen up.
We made her sit through that movie. Andrea was quiet. She stared at her legs. Her strong, beautiful legs that had nearly gotten her to the Olympics, that had locked around him when they were making love. This was the pornography of grief. Going back and remembering a moment in a dead person's life, step by step. So few people were willing to comb back through it like this, because it was too intimate or too painful, or it wouldn't help anything, it wouldn't bring the person back. But this, perhaps, was what Andrea needed. Let Tess live in the minute detail of their memories. Jeffrey could see Tess's teenage face as plain as day. He could see her bare toes on the spiky pedals of his Cannondale.
Thank you, Peach, Andrea said as she stood up to go. Thank you.
Jeffrey was at a loss because of both her arrival and her departure. You're welcome. Andrea continued to appear in Jeffrey's office. Jeffrey never knew when she would show. She didn't call or forewarn. He would climb the stairs to the attic, and there she would be, sitting in his chair. She always came in the morning, after she dropped off the twins at camp. Jeffrey started to anticipate her visits and look forward to them. On days she didn't come, he felt let down. He worried, stupidly, that he would never see her again. He had stumbled across what she wanted. She wanted someone else to remember Tess, to miss Tess, to tell stories about Tess. She wanted a partner in her grief, not a sympathetic listener. Any poor motherfucker could listen. She needed someone to share the burden, to do the talking and remembering for her. No one wanted to do this. There were certain ways in which Jeffrey didn't want to do this either, or couldn't do it. How much attention had he really given Tess, after all? But he would try for Andrea. He was methodical in all things, and so in this endeavor he moved chronologically. The broken arm story led to the story of Tess's first beer. Tess's first true cold beer had been consumed at a bonfire on Ladies Beach under the careful, almost parental watch of Jeffrey and Andrea. A Coors Light in a frosty silver can. Tess's arm was in a sling, her drinking arm, her everything arm. Jeffrey had to open the can for her and put it in her left hand. Had she asked for a beer? Jeffrey said. Or did we force it on her?
She asked for it, Andrea said.
Jeffrey did not remember it that way. He remembered that they had packed a cooler for a beach barbecue, and when they opened the cooler, they found they had nothing to drink except beer. They weren't used to hanging out with teenagers. He remembered saying to Tess, "Looks like it's beer or ocean water."
Andrea covered her eyes. Oh, God, she said. You're right.
And she drank the whole thing down right away and let out that burp they could hear in Portugal.
Yes, Andrea said.
She was most delighted by the details she had forgotten. And we gave her another one and another one and another one.
She drank 5, Jeffrey said.
And then she puked in the dunes, Andrea said. And we took her home and she passed out on the bathroom floor. And when she woke up in the morning, there were tile marks on her face.
Yes, Andrea shouted.
She put her hands up in the air. He had scored again.
And you made her sign that slip of paper, Jeffrey said.
Promising she wouldn't tell my aunt and uncle, Andrea said. She was laughing, then crying, sweetly weeping.
Thank you, Peach, she said.
God damn it, thank you.
You're welcome, he said.
How about the night Tess met Greg? Could Andrea handle that one? She looked dubious, but Jeffrey pointed out that he wasn't going to be able to tell stories for very long if he couldn't mention Greg.
Okay, she said.
Then she cocked her head.
Wait a minute. You weren't even there that night.
I still know the story. I've heard it 100 times. Do you want me to tell it or not?
Tell it.
Girls' Night Out, Summer 1995. Andrea, Tess, Delilah, Lisa Schumacher, who waitressed with Tess at the rope walk that summer, and Karen Pullman, who had taken over the head lifeguard position from Andrea when Andrea got pregnant with Casey. The girls went to dinner at the boarding house. They went for drinks at 21 Federal, drinks at the club car, drinks at the rope walk, where Lisa and Tess, on their night off, were treated like royalty and plied with tequila shots. Then, finally, they went to the Muse, to hear this band everyone was talking about called the Velociraptors. The Velociraptors were 5 guys who had done a PG year together at the Berkshire School and who had then done separate tours of duty at egregiously preppy colleges like Colgate and Bates and Middlebury and who had reunited on Nantucket. Greg McAvoy, Hamilton College, was the lead singer. He was 23 years old. He jogged and surfed and lifted weights. He wore a white rope bracelet and a shark's tooth on a leather choker. He sang while holding a Corona. He sang with his hair in his eyes. He sang Loving Cup by the Stones and Sheena is a Punk Rocker by the Ramones. He sang The Core by Eric Clapton with a hot redhead who tended bar and only came up on stage for that one song. It was well documented that Greg McAvoy, currently of the Velociraptors, formerly of the garage bands The Porn Stars and Eclipse, could have any woman he wanted. The band house behind the Muse, where the Velociraptors had pretty much taken up residence, though the drummer Beckett Steed's parents owned a house in Sconset, where they technically lived, had a throng of girls teeming around it every night after hours, like bacteria around a fresh cut. What happened in the band house? Well, pretty much what you'd expect. On the night in question, Tess was drunk.
We were all drunk, Andrea chimed in.
Tess was wearing jeans, flip-flops, a white t-shirt, a green bandana in her hair, and dangly silver earrings. She and the rest of the girls were dancing right up front. Their beers were sitting on the edge of the stage next to the amplifiers. With all the girls on the dance floor and the promise of yet more girls banging down the door of the band house, what was it about Tess that caught Greg's attention? The green bandana? The sparkling earrings? The freckles on her nose, or her big blue eyes, or her tiny feet with nails painted a color called cherry pie? She knew all the words to Low Spark of High-Heeled Boys. He noticed that. He smiled at her, winked at her. At the break, he said to his bass player,
"Hey, that little Gidget girl is hot."
He dispatched a roadie to speak to her. "Greg wants to know if you'll join him in the band house later." Roadie asked Tess this in front of all the girls. Rhody offered Tess a cold Corona, a present from Greg. The girls stared, speechless. Tess said, "The band house? No way." Isla said, "Are you crazy? Every woman on Nantucket wants that guy." But Andrea approved of Tess's answer. Andrea had a baby and a 2-year-old at home. She was mother superior. She was drinking and having fun like the rest of them, more than the rest of them. But she did not want to see her beloved younger cousin, Tess, disappear into the opium den slash syphilis shack that was the band house. Tess said no, and Greg was fired up. The hunt was on. What did he do to get her? Andrea scanned Jeffrey's desk for a piece of paper. She wanted to make a list. He tried to find out her last name, Jeffrey said. Failed, Andrea said. He tried to get her phone number. Failed. But then someone told him where she waitressed. He showed up at the rope walk with flowers. Didn't work. The next time he showed up with that CD he made her, with Romeo and Juliet by Dire Straits on it. Didn't work. He ordered the lobster dinner to impress her. It was just like Greg to be so misguided, Andrea said. Ordering the lobster was not impressive. He asked her out each and every time. Where did she want to go? The Chanticleer? The Walwinette? Beckett Steed's parents had a Boston Whaler. Did she want to go out on the Whaler? She told him she was afraid of the water, Andrea said quietly. Did she want to go on a picnic? Would she meet him for breakfast? Coffee? He showed up at her yoga class. He did all the positions, hoping she was watching him in her peripheral vision. He waited for her by the water cooler, but she breezed past him. He borrowed a dog, Andrea said. That golden retriever. Jeffrey shook his head. Jesus, I forgot about the dog. She almost fell for it, Andrea said. But when she found out it wasn't his, it set him back. So what was it in the end? Jeffrey said. The Greg in pursuit of Tess story was in fact a well-documented and much laughed about legend, and the first night at the Muse story could easily be told by people, like himself, who hadn't even been there. But what had flipped her? What had changed her mind? Jeffrey couldn't remember, or didn't know. I gave her permission, Andrea said. I told her the guy clearly deserved a chance. He was going to so much trouble. I told her it was okay to relent, to say yes. And that was all she needed. She did. Oh, Jeffrey said. Thank you, Peach. Jeffrey nodded. You're welcome. He did not tell anyone about Andrea's visitations or about the recounting of Tess's life in obscene detail, meaning he did not tell Delilah. This was unprecedented, because one of Jeffrey's hallmark qualities was that he was an open book. His accounts were honest, his slate clean. He hid nothing. He had no secrets. He prided himself on operating this way. He felt it gave him the upper hand. Delilah had secrets. She had hundreds of hours unaccounted for that fell under the category of time to myself and was therefore unimpeachable. She was always hiding something, covering up, making excuses. It was exhausting to live that way. Jeffrey could see the toll it took on her, harboring an entire emotional life she refused to share with him. He decided to keep Andrea's visits a secret, not for his sake, but for Andrea's sake. It went unspoken, but Jeffrey was pretty sure the chief knew nothing about the hours she whiled away in the farm attic. Delilah, if she knew, would get mad. She would feel threatened, though she claimed again and again that it was impossible to feel jealous of someone like Andrea. She would ridicule Jeffrey first, then Andrea. She would degrade their attempts at self-help, at memory as therapy. She would misunderstand it and misrepresent it to others and ruin it. It was working. Jeffrey could tell just by looking at Andrea that she felt better. And so did he. Phoebe. Her days grew happier and happier. She woke up and brewed an espresso. She had renewed her membership at the gym. She ran on the treadmill and lifted weights 3 times a week and attended Pilates 2x a week. On Saturdays and Sundays, she tried to get Addison to walk with her to the beach, but he usually said no, he didn't feel like it. He was too tired, too hungover, too lazy. So Phoebe went alone. She was secretly taking herself off her drugs. Back in 2001, after Reed died, She had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and then, in short order, depression. She took all the drugs prescribed to her and then some, twice as often as she was supposed to, and in this way, the pain had subsided. But along with the pain went everything else. Along with the pain went her personhood. Goodbye, Phoebe. In coming off the drugs, the whole thing was working in reverse. She could think, she could feel, she had appetites. This, she thought, was a basket of raspberries. Yum! This was an egg salad sandwich with arugula on wheat bread. She wanted to eat it in alternating bites with crisp, salty, gourmet potato chips, the juicy berries, and sips of iced tea with mint. Eating lunch, for the first time in years, gave her joy. Her pathological fear of calories was gone, too. She had desires. On a sunny day, she liked to sit for an hour or two by the pool. She liked the warm sun. She liked the cool water. While on the drugs, she had barely been able to tell the difference between the two. She called Delilah. She wanted to hang out with the kids. "You're kidding," Delilah said. Phoebe wanted to go to the beach, ride a boogie board to the shore on a monster wave and eat a face full of sand. She wanted to pick a popsicle out of the cooler and let it drip down her hands. The colors of the water and the sand and the eelgrass in the dunes and even of the popsicle startled her. Such deep, vibrant color. She could see it. She could appreciate it. It was as if she had been blind, and only now was her sight restored. The pink of the raspberries, the deep brown of her espresso, the turquoise of the swimming pool. Amazing. The sound of the boys, Drew and Barney, laughing. The sound of the waves crashing against the shore. The hum of airplanes making a landing. The James Taylor song on the boombox, Three Towels Down. She used to love that song. She still did. "I can't believe how wonderful I feel," Phoebe said. "That makes one of you," Delilah said. It was wrong, all wrong. It was backward. Addison was a shell, a husk. He was miserable and toadish. He was an abuser of alcohol. His lover had died and he was undergoing the predictable decline. Delilah, too, was suffering from nuclear fallout. Her hair was wild and hag-like. She admitted she could muster the energy to get in the shower only once a week. Once a week. She was getting dreadlocks. She had put on weight. Delilah had a very sexy, curvy figure, but she stuffed her face mindlessly with the Doritos and Chips Ahoy that she took to the beach for the kids, which went right to her ass. She complained about her ass and her dimpled thighs. She had a harder time getting out of her beach chair. She waddled to the waterline, but she kept on snarfing down the snacks. Phoebe invited her to go for walks to the beach or to Pilates class when the kids were in camp, but Delilah turned her down. "I don't have it in me, Phoebe." And she had quit her job. She couldn't work at the Begonia anymore, now that Greg was gone. Tom and Faith had replaced Greg with an Irish trio. Delilah had gone into work one shift to see if she could do it, but when the girl started crooning in her Gaelic accent, Delilah ran out of the bar in tears. She went through her closet and took all her hostessing dresses to the hospital thrift shop. "But why?" Phoebe said. "They were so pretty." "Because," Delilah said, "I'm never going to wear them again." She was declaring her life over and her sense of fun, which had always been her guiding principle, defeated. All she wanted to talk about was how much she hated Andrea and whether Greg had been screwing April Peck, neither of which interested Phoebe in the slightest. This was how people acted when two of their best friends died tragically. They suffered, they retreated, they regressed. Phoebe was the oddball. She did not want to dwell on Greg and April Peck, or Addison and Tess falling in love in the Quays cottage, or about her visit to Greg and Tess's house the night before their sale, or about the drowning. She wanted to move on, but it looked like she was going alone. Phoebe wanted something to do. She had agreed to co-chair the cocktail party for Island Conservation on August 15th. With 10 phone calls, the whole event was organized. tent, tables and chairs, caterer, donated beer and wine from Cisco Brewery, swing band, invites. Wheeler Realty was going to be a major underwriter, though Phoebe had cleared this only with Floribel, the receptionist. Addison did not have the attention span to take in the details. That accomplished, she was ready for the next thing. What was the next thing? She had nearly 8 years of energy stored up. Should she resurrect her business? Arrange group cruises through the Mediterranean for the over 65s? Perhaps join them on the cruise, jump off the ship at the Amalfi Coast, and take a young Italian lover? Phoebe ran across the twins by accident. They were in Nantucket Bookworks, standing quietly shoulder to shoulder in front of the chapter books. Phoebe had been adrift in paperback fiction. She thought maybe what her soul was craving was an education. There were so many books she hadn't read. Madame Bovary, Deliverance, A Room with a View, The Ice Storm, The Corrections, A Handmaid's Tale, A Thousand Acres, Bastard Out of Carolina, The Emperor's Children, Bel Canto. God, the list was endless. She picked a pile to start with. I Cannot Get You Close Enough, Prep, The Brambles, Beautiful Children, all from the staff favorites shelf. Someday in the near future, Phoebe would have her own shelf of favorites. It was a goal. She was all about goals. She wanted to add Catcher in the Rye to the pile, because that had been Reed's favorite book. Phoebe had read it. It had been required their sophomore year of high school. But she could not remember one single thing about it, except for the boy in Holden's class who would shout, "Digression," whenever the teacher got off the topic. But Phoebe thought she might even have been remembering that wrong. She could not find Catcher in the Rye on the shelf with the other Salinger novels. The woman behind the counter told her it was in the young adult section because it was on so many summer reading lists, and that was how Phoebe discovered the twins. Side by side, Darkhead Buzz Cut, Finn, next to Darkhead Bob, Chloe, both in stripy t-shirts and shorts. Phoebe nearly cried out at how darling they were, how quiet and serious. Finn was looking at something called Captain Underpants, and Chloe was flipping through A to Z Mysteries. There was something about their silence and composure that made them seem like little adults, a husband and wife, selecting books for a week of evening reading. Because they were twins, Phoebe had an incredibly tender spot in her heart for them. She felt connected to them in a way that she did not feel connected to Drew and Barney. Chloe and Finn were like Phoebe and Reed, a pair, a couple, connected at the hip. At the funeral, Phoebe had said to them, "You still have each other." And they had nodded in their composed, adult way. They didn't need her to tell them what they already knew. Phoebe did not speak to the twins in the bookstore or make herself known. They were too perfect. Phoebe wanted to gobble them up. She wanted to vaporize herself and inhabit their flawless bodies. They were so sad. They were babies abandoned in a basket. Tears welled in Phoebe's eyes. Could anyone help? Could Phoebe help? Was this it? The thing she was seeking? Was it the twins? She paid for her stack of books and scanned the store. Where was Andrea, or the chief? Later, Phoebe called Delilah on the phone and said, "I saw the twins at Bookworks by themselves, as in all alone. Does this seem right to you?" Delilah said, "It seems negligent. Andrea is unfit." Finn told Barney that Andrea smashed Greg's guitar against the kitchen counter right in front of the kids. "You're kidding," Phoebe said. "They should be living with us," Delilah said. "I should have fought for them." Fought for them, Phoebe thought. Phoebe saw the twins again a few days later, out in Sconset. They were eating ice cream cones on a bench in the pocket park adjacent to the Sconset Market. Phoebe was in her car. She had just enjoyed the world's most elegant lunch of lobster and mango salad, creme caramel, and a crisp Sancerre with her co-chair, Jennifer. Phoebe was a little high from the wine. She wasn't certain at first that the two children on the bench were the twins. Out of the corner of her eye, yes, she thought so. She looped around, enjoying Sconset. It was adorable, this little town, with its rose-covered cottages and the cafes and the tennis club and the magnificent summer homes on the bluff, which ended with the candy-striped lighthouse and the rolling green acreage of Sankaty Head Golf Course. Phoebe only came to Sconset on special occasions, and there hadn't been many special occasions in the past 8 years. The second time she passed the park, she saw the twins clearly. Again, sitting in silence, alone with their ice cream, staring straight ahead, licking. Phoebe slowed down. She looked for Andrea's car. Or the chief's? Because what would the twins be doing all the way out here on their own? Phoebe parked in front of the market. It felt like her heart had a zipper that was being pulled up and down, up and down. She did not see Andrea's car, nor the chief's. So maybe the kids had come on their bikes. All the way to Sconset? Was Andrea negligent? The twins did not see Phoebe. They did not appear to see anything except their ice cream. Phoebe was overcome with a desire to make them smile, to make them happy. Could she do it? If she approached them, would they acknowledge her? Of course they would. She had known them their entire lives. She had spent countless Sundays in their presence. But how did they think of her? They called her Phoebe, not Auntie Phoebe, even though Delilah was Auntie Dee and Andrea was simply Auntie. So Phoebe was not Auntie Phoebe. That was okay. She wasn't their aunt, like Andrea was, nor was she the mother of their dearest friends, like Delilah was. She was just some strange, childless woman who hung out with their parents and who spent most of her time checked into the dope motel. She was different now. Would they be able to tell? Should she offer to take them to her house and let them swim in the pool? Up and down. The twins. The thought thrilled her. A girl walked out of the Sconset market swigging from a bottle of Diet Pepsi, and the kids stood up and threw away their soiled napkins and the nubs of their cones. The girl was Andrea. No, it was Casey. Phoebe's heart whistled. She let out a soft sans-serre burp. She was relieved that there was a responsible person out here with the twins. But she was deflated, too. The twins were darling and wholesome. They were Hansel and Gretel, and she, Phoebe, was some kind of witch. Casey and the twins extracted their bikes from the rack. The twins mounted their bikes, and the bikes wobbled, like fawns standing on new legs. Then they balanced themselves, they pedaled and gained speed. They were steady and confident, and Phoebe smiled as she watched them go. She wanted something, but it was not the twins. It was like a bad dream. It was the middle of the night, pitch black. Now that Phoebe was off the Ambien, she needed the shades drawn and the air conditioning on full blast in order to sleep. But the storm woke her up. Lightning flashed around the edges of the shades, and the thunder sounded like someone on the second floor was picking up large pieces of furniture and then letting them drop. That wasn't the scary part, however. The scary part was Addison sitting up, eyes wide open, watching her. He was not wearing his glasses, and for a second, she didn't recognize him. "Jesus, Ad," she said. She liked even this, however, the ability to be startled, to be frightened. He said, "The present." She said, "What?" Though she knew right away. "What was the anniversary present," he said, "that you gave Tess?" She looked at her husband. He was staring at her, but could he see her? She had an urge to, what? Jump out of bed and run into the storm? Run down to the basement and hide in her cedar closet? "It's none of your business," Phoebe said. "Is it?" This last little bit was a dare on her part. "If Tess is your business, tell me why," Tell me she was your lover. Tell me you were in love with her. But Phoebe didn't want to hear him confess. She knew what she knew, but he didn't know what she knew, and that meant it wasn't real. Phoebe realized in that instant that with or without the drugs, she had always chosen to live in a fantasy world, and she wanted to keep it that way. She touched Addison's shoulder. He wore a long-sleeved t-shirt and his flannel pajama pants. The AC was set at something like 50 degrees. It was so cold he claimed he could see his breath. He did not respond to her touch, even though it had become some kind of crazy rule, established, she knew, by crazy Phoebe, that they did not touch in bed. Her medication had not only sapped her sex drive, it had made her irrationally afraid of sex. Or she was afraid of sex because in recent years, Addison had only pursued her when very drunk, when he was rough and he hurt her. They had had a lovely, tender sex life years and years ago, back when they were both different people. Now, along with everything else, Phoebe found herself interested in sex again. Her body resumed its humming rhythm. She had actually gotten a period, and even the blood and the cramping had seemed, if not wonderful, then at least natural and right, a return to life. She was a woman again. It had occurred to her that what she wanted was a sex life, a sensual life. Hours with Addison where they touched and teased, kissed and stroked, gave each other massages and took candlelit baths. She wanted to climax under his finger or with him pumping inside her. Would it be difficult to get something like this underway? Addison had tried everything both holistic and black market to get Phoebe interested in sex again. Porn videos, vibrators, scented oils, Barry White CDs, Anais Nin, and nothing had worked. Would it be the same now, only in reverse? She stroked his arm with what she meant to be a suggestive up-and-down motion. Again her heart did its zippering and unzippering, up and down. She was pulsing between the legs. "Do you want to make love?" she asked. He looked at her. Again the empty, blind man gaze. "I want you to tell me about the present." Thunder. A crack like a very big bone breaking, and then the rumble. "I won't." He fell onto his side as if shot. Phoebe would not accept this. She crossed the invisible boundary into Addison territory. He had the western half of the bed, she the eastern, and slid her hand beneath the drawstring waistband of his pajama pants. She touched him, hoping. But he was shriveled, flaccid. She retracted her hand and thought of apologizing. And then Addison started to sob. Still, she thought, she wanted something. If that something was Addison, she could wait it out. She could be as patient as he had been. She could fix their relationship, sew the head back onto the doll, rescue the fallen souffle. She found the poem, or it found her, on the hottest day of the summer. Addison came home from the office at 4 and said he wanted to stay in the pool until nightfall. "Okay," Phoebe said. "Just as long as you keep your head above water." This was said lightly, though Phoebe worried that Addison would pour himself 4 or 5 bourbons, lie on his inflatable raft, fall asleep, and inadvertently slip to the bottom of the pool without her noticing. Another drowning. He couldn't get into his swim trunks fast enough. Addison, who was always fastidious, very sloppily emptied his pockets all over the granite countertops, too close to where Phoebe was attempting both to brew iced tea and to shred a rotisserie chicken for chicken salad. Phoebe had never been much of a cook, but she had watched Delilah make chicken salad 100 times, watched her through someone else's prescription eyeglasses, it seemed now. It was easy. Shredded chicken, celery, chives, mayonnaise, salt, pepper, and the secret ingredient straight out of Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar. Tonight, Phoebe thought triumphantly, they would eat a dinner she'd prepared herself. When Addison opened the door to go out to the pool, full jack-over-ice in hand, The hot wind lifted the poem off the pile of debris evacuated from his pockets. The money, the change, the business cards, the single piece of root beer-flavored hard candy. And it wafted into the melee of ingredients that was to become the chicken salad. Phoebe lifted the poem with her nails. Her fingers were coated with chicken grease. A poem, ripped from somewhere. She read the poem, keen to understand it. Literature was her friend now. She had finished Catcher in the Rye and was halfway through the Ellen Gilchrist. The poem was straightforward. She got it, but not really. A birthday party in a restaurant, the men's room, someone pissing Asti Spumanti, macho. Then Phoebe came to the underlined verses. My life with you has been beyond beyond, and there's nothing beyond it I'm seeking. I wouldn't mind being dead if I could still be with you. Phoebe set the poem back down on the pile of Addison's things and weighted it with his keys. She had seen the poem before. She had seen it at Tess's house. Tess had handed it to her. She'd said, "Look at this." Phoebe had pretended to read it, but of course the words had been little more than ants on sugar. "It's beautiful," she had told Tess. Tess had sniffled a little bit. Everything made that woman cry. Phoebe scooped mayonnaise into the bowl with abandon. Addison could not be saved. She would have to find something else to want. The chief. He summoned them to the Begonia because he didn't know where else to go, and because he hadn't yet decided whether he should tell them about the tox report or keep it a secret. If they went to the Begonia, it could be passed off as simply the three of them meeting for beers. Since the evening after Greg and Tess's funeral, they had done nothing as a group. Nothing. It was odd, and the unexpected thing was, the chief missed it. He missed gathering. He missed drinking cold beer out on the Drake's deck. He missed being invited to swim in Addison's pool. He missed Delilah's cooking. She had a knack for always knowing what he was craving. He missed sitting on the beach in a semicircle, talking about boats and listening to the Sox game on the last transistor radio in America, which he had bought on eBay. Delilah called the house once to invite them and the twins over for a barbecue, but Andrea had said no. When the chief asked why, Andrea said, "I don't care if I ever go over there again." So along with Greg and Tess, something else had died. The chief got to the Begonia first, and Faith greeted him at the door. He kissed her rouged cheek. She said, "How you doing?" in a way that seemed to be asking more than the obvious. And he said, "Oh, Jesus, Faith, as well as can be expected, I guess." Faith said, "We sure do miss him." He could do a little detective work here. The Begonia had been Greg's third place, after home and the school. If Greg had been talking to someone who sold drugs, Faith might know about it. But it was imperative to keep things under wraps, and Faith, while a decent woman, was Nantucket's answer to a daily newspaper. If it was happening, she would tell you about it. He asked to be seated at the back table, the one that was shielded by half walls. Everyone called it the mafia table. Normally, the chief liked to sit at the bar where he could see the TV and lend an air of neighborhood security to the establishment, but tonight he needed the mafia table. He said to Faith, "I'm meeting Ad and Jeffrey." She nodded, set down menus, and said, "Please know that Tom and I are thinking of you, and we're thinking of Andrea." The chief said, "Appreciate that." Faith lingered a second, and the chief panicked. He did not want to get involved in a conversation. He picked up his menu, even though he always ordered the blue burger, and Faith reluctantly wandered away. He took a deep breath. Beer, onion rings, exhaust from the stove. The Sox were on TV, and the jukebox was playing Tom Petty. He was in the Scarlet Begonia. He was okay, despite the fact that the tox report was eating at him like a tapeworm, despite the fact that Andrea was certifiably nuts and needed a padded room on a quiet farm in central Pennsylvania. Andrea thought about nothing other than Tess. Tess drowning in Nantucket Sound, Tess almost drowning in Boston Harbor as a child, Tess miscarrying once, losing the second baby in a fall, miscarrying again, Tess suffering through the weeks of Greg's inquisition, Tess withdrawing from Andrea right after Christmas. This last thing seemed to be the corn kernel stuck in Andrea's back molar. For the 6 months prior to Tess's death, Tess had been distant and strange. Andrea had felt her pulling away. It would have been imperceptible to anyone other than Andrea, but Andrea had sensed that something was wrong. Tess didn't confide in Andrea. She went 2 and 3 days without checking in. And worst of all, she had stopped going to Mass with Andrea on Saturday evenings, which was the 1 hour of the week that they reserved not only for the Lord, but for each other. Andrea was so consumed with her interior life that she didn't always notice what was going on around her. The twins had their own set of complicated needs, food, clothing, a chauffeur service, enriching ways to pass the time indoors and outdoors, athletic and educational, for all of their waking hours. Andrea could barely meet the minimum requirements: drop off, pick up, breakfast, lunch, dinner, bath, bedtime. If there were to be outings, if there was to be fun, it had to be provided by Eric, Casey, or the chief. Eric and Casey had jobs and friends. The chief had a police force to run and an island to keep safe. They did what they could, but it was clear the twins were unhappy. Not only devastated by the tragic loss of both their parents, but bored and uninspired by their new life in the Capenash house. On Sundays, when the chief was in charge, he asked the twins what they wanted to do, and they invariably said they wanted to play with Drew and Barney. They wanted to go to Auntie Dee's house. And though that would have been killing two birds with one stone, he would be making the kids happy and resurrecting some of his lost social life. His mouth watered at the thought of grilled corn, cherry tomatoes stuffed with guacamole, the wickedly spicy tuna tartare that Delilah made in the summer. He could not, in good conscience, take the kids over there. Andrea would unhinge. This happened more and more frequently. The guitar smashing had been the worst, followed by dumping a platter of perfectly grilled ribeye steaks into her perennial bed, followed by throwing her cell phone into the ocean. The kids were terrified of Andrea. One morning, Finn ate his Cheerios without milk because he was afraid to ask for some. Chloe had a bad case of the night terrors. She woke up calling for her mom, and Andrea lay there with her eyes open, but made no move to deal with it. So the chief would walk Chloe back to bed, find her doll, and try to make a convincing, whispered argument that everything was going to be okay. The poor kid was craving her mother, a woman with peppy energy and feminine warmth, and what she got was her gruff uncle, who had a big, scary job and carried a gun. In a brave moment, the chief had told Andrea that the best way to honor Tess now was to concentrate on caring for the children. Andrea had basically spit on him for that. She said, "I am caring for them, Ed." But she wasn't. She was too caught up in her grief. It was backward, upside down, inside out. Here at the Begonia, the chief stroked the scarred tabletop. Addison was next to arrive, and he must have stopped at the bar because he was carrying a drink. The chief stood, they shook hands, Addison sat down opposite, and the chief felt nervous suddenly, like he was on a blind date. He and Addison had been friends for eons. It was true that he and Addison did not have a whole heck of a lot in common. Addison was slippery like a fish, impossible to grasp. He had had a fancy education. He'd lived and worked in other countries. He had a daughter who lived in California, like a character in one of those teen Disney shows that Chloe wanted to watch, but Andrea prohibited. Addison was a businessman. He was Nantucket's real estate magnate. He did deals where he made so much money it felt illegal. He made connections, he culled favors, he lived in a 6,000-square-foot house with his fragile wife. The chief had always respected the way Addison fretted over Phoebe, especially now that the chief had his own wife to worry about. The chief and Addison had once been lost in the woods together. They had rented a canoe during their group trip to Saranac Lake, paddled around the wrong bend, the chief had chosen incorrectly, He'd insisted, despite Addison's protests, and ended up in East who the fuck knows. They had no map. Two big, strong men, no need for a map. Half a bottle of Evian, and no food except for breath mints. They each had a cell phone, but no goddamn reception. They were out on the lake for hours, and when they were supposed to meet the hotel pickup truck at the end point, they were lost. They decided to pull onto land and carry the canoe and look for a road, hitch a ride back to the refuge of their elegant resort, the Point, where everyone else was getting ready for dinner and most likely starting to worry. They pulled off into thick, almost impenetrable woods. They considered getting back into the canoe, but that felt like regressing. They battled through the brush while holding the canoe over their heads. The chief had worked with guys who had been to Vietnam. He'd heard stories just like everyone else about the dense jungle, the bugs, the snakes, the booby traps. What the chief and Addison were dealing with now was, of course, not warfare, but the conditions weren't much more favorable. The mosquitoes were thick and whining, there were thorns everywhere, and mud. Addison was, ridiculously, wearing Ferragamo loafers. The canoe hindered them tremendously. At one point, they were tempted just to ditch it, but it belonged to the resort. It was a beautiful wooden canoe and had probably cost thousands of dollars. It was growing dark, they couldn't see, the mosquitoes were like motherfucking tigers. The chief was dying of thirst. He was so thirsty he would gladly have drunk lake water, despite whatever kind of gut-rotting dysentery it would give him, but by now, he estimated, they were at least a quarter mile inland. They were both tired. They decided to rest. They had been paddling all day in the sun. The resort had packed them an excellent picnic lunch, which they had devoured 6 hours earlier. They sat on top of the overturned canoe and swatted at mosquitoes and caught their breath and surveyed their surroundings. Woods and more woods. The chief was trying not to panic. He was a policeman. He had heard countless stories just like this. Man out enjoying nature for the day that ended in tragedy. They had to keep going. They had to ditch the canoe. It was too cumbersome. Addison said that he would pay for it. The chief said they could argue about that later, once they found some goddamn civilization that included a hot shower, clean sheets, and a cold beer. Once it was just the two of them, minus the albatross of the canoe, they moved much faster. They ran in places. They had decided to move in only one direction, toward the sunset, west, which was, theoretically, the direction in which the resort was located. But west went on forever. To keep from getting discouraged, Addison told the chief stories of the wild days when he was married to the stick-thin, chain-smoking socialite Mary Rose Garth, who loved seeking out scandal the way other women love chocolate. And then he told the real story of why he got kicked out of Princeton the week before he graduated. The chief swore never to divulge the details. These were fantastic stories. They passed the time. And the chief tried to come up with his own stories, but he had never been married to a woman who liked to bring another woman home to bed or throw last year's couture on the library fire. And so what he realized in the woods was that although he was a police chief, his life had been pretty dull. They noticed the woods starting to thin out. Then they hit a road. A road! A motherfucking road! They'd hit the jackpot. All roads led to somewhere. But maybe not this one. It was a dirt road, and half an hour later, not a single vehicle had driven past. Addison tried his phone and got a cell signal. While he was dialing the hotel, all he would be able to tell everyone was that they were alive, the chief saw headlights, and along came an honest-to-God VW bus with two hippies inside smoking a doobie as if they had arrived straight out of 1967. Addison and the chief gratefully climbed into the green haze of the back seat. There were two men sitting up front, if kids in their 20s with wispy beards and remnants of acne could be called men. They were listening to John Hyatt on the radio, and the chief said happily upon settling in his seat, "Love the music." "Where are we dropping you?" the driver asked. He was wearing a purple t-shirt and a pair of John Lennon sunglasses with purple-tinted lenses. "The Point,"
Addison said with obnoxious authority, as though they were in Manhattan and this was their cab.
Whoa!
The passenger up front said. He was the one actually holding the joint, and after hearing the name of their hotel, he inhaled again and while holding his smoke said,
"Sweet place."
The point was sweet. It was the finest place the chief and Andrea had ever stayed at, with its rustic luxury, every detail attended to, including the temperature at which the red wine was served and the type of pillow each guest preferred. The point was a resort for the rich. The chief understood that Cheech and Chong here would now mistake him and Addison for wealthy men, and while this bothered him and he yearned to set the record straight, he really just wanted to get back. "Can you take us there?" he asked.
"No prob," the driver said.
He looked at his companion and said,
"Wanna offer our friends a taste?"
The passenger, who looked like he was trying to grow in mutton chop sideburns, passed the joint back over the seat. Addison took it without hesitation. "I haven't smoked in 20 years, he said. "But I have just been lost in the wilderness and experienced what I can most accurately describe as fear for my life, and a little spliff feels like exactly what I need right now."
"Amen," the passenger said.
Addison inhaled deeply with his eyes closed, held the smoke, and then let the stream go.
"Smooth as silk," he said.
The chief looked upon Addison not with shock or disgust, but rather with envy. He wanted to smoke, to have a looseness enter his stiff and sore muscles, but he just couldn't.
"No thanks," said the chief.
"Come on," the passenger said.
"Can't, really.
Random drug testing at work." The random drug testing among Nantucket's police officers had been the chief's idea.
"Bummer," the driver said. "What's your line of work?"
"He's a police chief," Addison said. There was a pause. One beat, then two. The song changed to Paul McCartney and Wings singing Band on the Run. The chief wanted to deck Addison. What if these potheads got unnecessarily paranoid and decided to dump them? They would be only half a mile closer to home. But instead, the passenger, Master Scrawny Sideburns, burst out laughing. It was a giggly and girlish sound, and this set the driver laughing. Then, in a drug-induced delayed reaction, Addison laughed. He laughed so hard he held his stomach.
"Police chief," he said.
The driver could barely keep the van on the road. His tiny glasses slipped down his nose. He hunched over the steering wheel. It took several minutes for them to collect their wits. But when they did, Master Scrawny Sideburn said,
"Well there, Mr. Police Chief, would you like a beer?"
The chief said, "Yes, please." And that was now the chief's own best story. Addison looked worse sitting across the table at the begonia than he had after being lost in the woods for 3 hours and enduring what had ended up being a 45-minute drive back to the secure luxury of the point. Then he had been mussed and torn and mud-caked and mosquito-bitten and sunburned and stoned out of his mind. And now, although his shirt was pressed and his hair tidy, he looked bloated and pale and tragically sad. He looked, the chief thought, like a bald male version of Andrea. There had been a guy in the force in Swampscott who had lost his partner in a botched arrest, and as a sign of his grief, he had tattooed half his face. The grief of the people close to the chief was just as clear and indelible as Sergeant Cutone's tattoo. And as with the sergeant, the chief could barely stand to look at Addison. He had to avert his eyes. In this part of the restaurant, there were only 2 tables seated, and the chief did not recognize the people. Tourists. The TV set was too far away to see the score of the Sox game. A waitress approached with a Budweiser for the chief and another drink for Addison, even though he already had a healthy drink in front of him. She set the drinks down and said, "Would you like to place an order?" Addison shook his head. "Nothing for me." The chief was starving. Andrea had fed the twins microwaved hot dogs on some stale-looking buns, along with a couple of slices of pale watermelon. And although the chief liked kid food,
chicken nuggets, mac and cheese. Nothing about the twins' meal had appealed to him or to them. To be polite, he should wait for Jeffrey before he ordered, but etiquette was not the chief's strong suit, and everyone knew it. Blue burger, well done, please. Fries, coleslaw with extra horseradish, and start me with something, the jalapeno poppers.
Will do, the waitress said.
Jesus, Ed, Addison said. I know, the chief said. It's a one-way ticket on the Heartburn Express.
Addison swilled the rest of his drink as if it were water and jostled the ice.
Jesus yourself, the chief said.
Yeah, Addison said.
Phoebe thinks I have a problem.
Do you?
Have a problem?
He laughed joylessly.
I have a few.
I'm going to be honest with you, the chief said. You don't look that great.
Am I supposed to look great? It hasn't even been a month.
Can you believe it? It's only been 26 days, but it's like our whole reality has changed.
You're taking it hard?
Is there another way to take it?
Addison's eyes welled with tears.
The chief had seen it all during his 17 years on the force, but one of his least favorite things was watching a grown man cry. He thought about all the phone calls between Tess and Addison on the day before Tess died. 5 phone calls from Addison to Tess on the final morning. He had been trying to reach her, but why? Along with the tox report and what to do about Andrea, this was one of the things the chief turned over incessantly in his mind. There had to be an explanation. Should he ask? Among the 4 men, Greg and Addison had been the closest friends. They were the outgoing, party-all-the-time type who attended bachelor parties and took golf weekends, who went fishing and sailing and played bocce on the beach, clinking beer bottles after a good lie and offering high fives. When Addison got Celtics tickets, or front row to see Jimmy Buffett, he always took Greg. Greg was his little buddy, his much younger fraternity brother. Addison told a joke, and Greg was the first to laugh. That, perhaps, was the reason Addison looked like a jigsaw puzzle with a couple of pieces missing. He'd lost his sidekick, his Sundance Kid. The chief said, Andrea's a mess. What about Phoebe?
Phoebe? Addison said. He sucked down the first third of his second drink and said,
The strange thing is that Phoebe is just fine. She's actually better than she's been in a long time. I'm sure everyone thought Phoebe would collapse. This would be the last straw, but she's great. She's exercising, eating, smiling. The chief said. He had seen Phoebe on the 4th and had noticed how luminous she looked. And how goes it with the estate?
The estate? Addison looked perplexed.
Oh, fine. We're going to list the house at 7:50.
The chief nodded.
There were 40 or 50 follow-up questions to ask about the house and the furnishings and the personal effects, the business of the deaths, the selling off and cleaning up of 2 full lives, but the chief wanted to ask about the phone calls. Who knew when he would get another chance? He was a policeman. He had to know. He would be direct, no funny business, no innuendo. I noticed there were a bunch of calls from you to Tess on the morning she died. 5, to be exact.
Addison stared.
The eye contact was reassuring, because what did a liar do? He dropped his eyes to his drink.
Was something going on? The chief asked.
Going on? Happening. Was she thinking of selling the house or renting a place for her college roommate or?
He was giving Addison a chance to lie here and put his mind at ease, at least temporarily.
Why so many phone calls?
Addison shrugged. His stare did not relent.
We were friends.
Well, obviously, the chief said. We were all friends.
But why were you trying to reach her? 5 phone calls in 30 minutes? What for?
What for?
Yeah.
Addison hunched his shoulders.
What are you asking me, Ed?
I'm asking what you wanted to talk to her about. If you saw 6 calls from me to Tess, you would want to know what was going on, wouldn't you? You would want to know what we were talking about. I would figure it was your business. I wouldn't interrogate you. That's not what I'm doing. It sure as hell sounds like it. Okay, well, while I'm at it, I have another question. Addison held eye contact. What would that be? In the bag of the items the Coast Guard recovered was Tess's phone. You have the phone. You just said you checked it. It went missing the day she died, that night. And you were at the Drake house. Did you take Tess's cell phone? Do you have it? Addison's nostrils flared ever so slightly. No. I need you to tell me the truth. The phone could have clues still on it. I didn't look at her text messages, for example. Why not? I didn't have time. I was dealing with Andrea. The chief paused. Do you have the phone, Addison? Just tell me. No. Okay, the chief said. He was sure now that Addison did have the phone, but what could he do? Get a search warrant? Turn the phone into evidence? Let the whole island know that Tess's and Greg's deaths were, maybe, more than an accident? If you find the phone, the chief said, if for some reason Phoebe has it or it turns up, you'll be the first to know, Addison said. The waitress approached timidly with the jalapeno poppers. She looked nervous. It was the mafia table replete with men speaking in angry whispers. The chief waved her in. Food, yes, hurry, put the plate down, the chief was starving. He ate when he was nervous or stressed out, and he was both things in extremis right now. He popped a popper right away, then regretted it. The popper was filled with molten lava that branded his tongue with a sizzling hiss. He gasped and nearly spit the glowing coal into his napkin, but both the waitress and Addison were watching him. If Addison could bluff, so could he. Thumbs up, delicious. Another beer, he whispered, please. And a drink for me, Addison said. Just like that, the moment was past, the topic was kaput, and to revisit the question of the cell phone or the reason for Addison's phone calls would seem aggressive. The chief would not be able to uncover anything. Addison, despite his diminished appearance, was cunning. That Ivy League education meant something, as did the charm, the business acumen, the money, the languages, the connections. Addison was as slippery as a fish, but he would not get caught like a fish.